Departure. First, Aragorn had Garvan, with all secrecy, send one of the Nighthawks to collect provisions for the trip to Vroengard. Saphira had eaten after the capture of Dras Leona, but she had not gorged herself, else she would have been too slow and too heavy to fight if the need arose, as indeed it had. She was well enough fed then to fly to Vroengard without stopping, but once there, Aragorn knew she would have to find food on or around the island, which worried him.
"I can always fly back on an empty stomach," she assured him,
but he was not so certain. Next, Aragorn sent a runner to bring Jormungandr and Blodgarn to his tent. Once they arrived, it took Aragorn, Arya and Saphira another hour to explain the situation to them, and harder still, to convince them that the trip was necessary. Blodgarn was the easiest to win over to their point of view, whereas Jormungandr objected vociferously, not because he doubted the veracity of the information from Solombam, nor even because he doubted its importance. On both those points, he accepted Aragorn's word without question. But, as he argued with increasing vehemence, because it would destroy the Varden if they woke to find not only that Nasuada had been kidnapped, but that Aragorn and Saphira had vanished to parts unknown.
"Furthermore, we don't dare let Galbatorix think that you've left us," Jormungandr said. "Not when we're so close to Urabane. He might send Murtagh and Thorn to intercept you, or he might take the opportunity to crush the Varden once and for all. We can't risk it."
His concerns, Aragorn was forced to acknowledge, were valid. After much discussion, they finally arrived at a solution. Blodgarm and the other elves would create apparitions of both Aragorn and Saphira, even as they had created one of Aragorn when he had gone to the Beor Mountains to participate in the election and coronation of Hrothgar's successor. The images would appear to be perfect, living, breathing, thinking replicas of Aragorn and Saphira, but their minds would be empty, and if anyone peered into them, the ruse would be discovered. As a result, the image of Saphira would be unable to speak, and although the elves could feign speech on the part of Aragorn, that too would be better to avoid, lest some oddity of diction alert those listening that all was not as it seemed. The limitations of the illusions meant that they would work best at a distance, and that the people who had reason to interact with Aragorn and Saphira on a more personal basis, such as the kings Orin and Oric, would soon realize that something was amiss. So Aragorn ordered Garvan to wake all the Nighthawks and bring them to him as discreetly as possible. When the whole company was gathered before his tent, Aragorn explained to the motley group of men, dwarves and Urgals why he and Saphira were leaving, although he was purposefully vague about the details, and he kept their destination a secret. Then he explained how the elves were going to conceal their absence, and he had the men swear oaths of secrecy in the ancient language. He trusted them, but one could never be too careful where Galbatorix and his spies were concerned. Afterward, Aragorn and Arya visited Orin, Oric, Roran, and the sorceress Triana. As with the Nighthawks, they explained the situation, and from each of them extracted oaths of secrecy. King Orin, as Aragorn expected, proved to be the most intransigent. He expressed outrage at the prospect of either Aragorn or Saphira travelling to Vroengard, and railed at length against the idea. He questioned Aragorn's bravery, questioned the value of Solombam's information, and threatened to withdraw his forces from the Varden if Aragorn continued to pursue such a foolish, misguided course. It took over an hour of threats, flattery, and coaxing to bring him around. And even then, Aragorn feared Orin might go back on his word. The visits to Oric, Roran, and Triana went faster, but Aragorn and Arya still had to spend what seemed to Aragorn an unreasonable amount of time talking with them. Impatience made him curt and restless. He wanted to be off, and every minute that passed only increased his sense of urgency. As he and Arya went from person to person, Aragorn was also aware, through his link with Saphira, of the elves' faint, lilting chanting, which underlay everything he heard, like a strip of cunningly woven fabric hidden beneath the surface of the world. Saphira had remained at his tent, and the elves were ringed about her, their arms outstretched and the tips of their fingers touching while they sang. The purpose of their long, complicated spell was to collect the visual information they would need in order to create an accurate representation of Sephira. It was difficult enough to imitate the shape of an elf or a human. A dragon was harder still, especially given the refractive nature of her scales. Even so, the most complicated part of the illusion, as Blodgam had told Aragorn, would be reproducing the effects of Sephira's weight on her surroundings every time her apparition took off or landed. When, at last, Aragorn and Arya had finished making their rounds, night had already given way to day, and the morning sun hung a hand's breadth above the horizon. By its light, the damage wrought upon the camp during the attack seemed even greater. Aragorn would have been happy to depart with Sephira and Gleda then, but Jormungandr insisted that he address the Vardan at least once, properly, as their new leader. Therefore, soon afterward, once the army was assembled, Aragorn found himself standing in the back of an empty wagon, looking out over a field of upturned faces, some human and some not, and wishing he were anywhere but there. Aragorn had asked Rohan for advice beforehand, and Rohan had told him, "Remember, they're not your enemies. You have nothing to fear from them. They want to like you. Speak clearly, speak honestly, and whatever you do, keep your doubts to yourself. That's the way to win them over. They're going to be frightened and dismayed once you tell them about Nasawada. Give them the reassurance they need, and they'll follow you through the very gates of Urubain." Despite Rohan's encouragement, Aragorn still felt apprehensive before his speech. He had rarely spoken to large groups before, and never for more than a few lines. As he gazed at the sun-darkened, battle-worn warriors before him, he decided that he would rather fight 100 enemies by himself than have to stand up in public and risk the disapproval of others. Until the moment he opened his mouth, Aragorn was not sure what he was going to say. Once he started, the words seemed to pour out of their own accord, but he was so tense he could not remember much of what he said. The speech passed in a blur. His main impressions were of heat and sweat, the groans of the warriors when they learned of Nasawada's fate, the ragged cheers when he exhorted them to victory, and the general roar from the crowd when he finished. With relief, he jumped down from the back of the wagon to where Arya and Oryk were waiting next to Sephira. As he did, his guards formed a circle around the four of them, shielding them from the crowd and holding back those who wished to speak with him.
"Well done, Aragorn," said Oryk, clapping him on the arm.
"Was it?" Aragorn asked, feeling dazed. "You were most eloquent," said Arya. Aragorn shrugged, embarrassed. It intimidated him to remember that Arya had known most of the leaders of the Vardan, and he could not help but think that Arjahad or his predecessor Daenor would have done a better job with the speech. Oryk pulled on his sleeve. Aragorn bent toward the dwarf. In a voice barely loud enough to be heard over the crowd, Oryk said,
"I hope that whatever you find is worth the trip, my friend. Take care you don't get yourselves killed, eh?"
"I'll try not to." To Aragorn's surprise, Oryk grabbed him by the forearm and pulled him into a rough embrace.
"May Gunterra watch over you."
As they separated, Oryk reached over and slapped the palm of his hand against Sephira's side.
"And you as well, Sephira. Safe journeys to the both of you."
Sephira responded with a low hum. Aragorn looked over at Arya. He suddenly felt awkward, unable to think of anything but the most obvious things to say. The beauty of her eyes still captivated him. The effect she had on him never seemed to lessen. Then she took his head in her hands, and she kissed him once, formally, on the brow. Aragorn stared at her, dumbstruck. "Gulie weiza medono, Arjutlam." "Luck be with you, Silverhand." As she released him, he caught her hands in his own. "Nothing bad is going to happen to us. I won't let it. Not even if Galbatorix is waiting for us. If I have to, I'll tear apart mountains with my bare hands. But I promise we're going to make it back safely." Before she could respond, he let go of her hands and climbed onto Sephira's back. The crowd began to cheer again as they saw him settle into the saddle. He waved to them and they redoubled their efforts, stamping their feet and pounding their shields with the pommels of their swords. Aragorn saw Blodgarm and the other elves gathered in a close-knit group, half-hidden behind a nearby pavilion. He nodded to them, and they nodded in return. The plan was simple. He and Saphira would set off as if they intended to patrol the skies and scout the land ahead, as they normally did when the army was on the march. But after circling the camp a few times, Saphira would fly into a cloud, and Aragorn would cast a spell that would render her invisible to those watching from below. Then the elves would create the hollow wraiths that would take Aragorn and Saphira's place while they continued on with their journey, and it would be the wraiths that onlookers would see emerge from the cloud. Hopefully, none would notice the difference. With practiced ease, Aragorn tightened the straps around his legs and checked that the saddlebags behind him were properly secured. He took special care with the one on his left, for packed within it, well swaddled with clothes and blankets, was the velvet-lined chest that contained Glaedhr's precious heart of hearts, his Eldunari.
"Let us be off," the old dragon said. "To Froen God,"
Saphira exclaimed, and the world pitched and plunged around Aragorn as she leaped off the ground, and a rush of air buffeted him as she flapped her massive bat-like wings, driving them higher and higher into the sky. Aragorn tightened his grip on the next spike in front of him, lowered his head against the speed-induced wind, and stared at the polished leather of his saddle. He took a deep breath and tried to stop worrying about what lay behind them and what lay before them. There was nothing he could do now but wait. Wait and hope that Saphira could fly to Vroengard and back before the Empire attacked the Varden again. Hope that Roran and Arya would be safe. Hope that he might somehow still be able to rescue Nessawada. And hope that going to Vroengard was the right decision. For the time was fast approaching when he would finally have to face Galbatorix. The Torment of Uncertainty. Nessawada opened her eyes. Tiles covered the dark, vaulted ceiling, and upon the tiles were painted angular patterns of red, blue, and gold, a complex matrix of lines that trapped her gaze for a mindless while. At last, she mustered the will to look away. A steady orange glow emanated from a source somewhere behind her. The glow was just strong enough to reveal the shape of the octagonal room, but not so bold as to dispel the shadows that clung like gauze to the corners above and below. She swallowed, and found her throat was dry. The surface she lay on was cold, smooth, and uncomfortably hard. It felt like stone against her heels and the pads of her fingers. A chill had crept into her bones, and it was that which caused her to realize the only thing she wore was the thin white shift she slept in. Where am I? The memories returned all at once, without sense or order, an unwelcome cavalcade that thundered into her mind with a force almost physical in its intensity. She gasped and tried to sit upright, to bolt, to flee, to fight if she had to, but found she was unable to move more than a fraction of an inch in any direction. There were padded manacles around her wrists and ankles, and a thick leather belt held her head firmly against the slab, preventing her from lifting or turning it. She strained against her bonds, but they were too strong for her to break. Letting out her breath, she went limp and stared at the ceiling again. Her pulse hammered in her ears like a maddened drumbeat. Heat suffused her body, her cheeks burned, and her hands and feet felt as if they were filled with molten tallow. So this is how I die. For a moment, despair and self-pity bedeviled her. She had barely begun her life, yet now it was about to end, and in the vilest, most miserable manner possible. What was worse, she had accomplished none of the things she had hoped to. Not war, not love, not birth, not life. Her only offspring were battles and corpses and trundling supply trains, stratagems too numerous to remember, oaths of friendship and fealty now worth less than a mummer's promise. and a halting, fractious, all-too-vulnerable army, led by a rider younger than she was herself. It seemed a poor legacy for the memory of her name, and her memory would be all that remained. She was the last of her line. When she died, there would be no one left to continue her family. The thought pained her, and she berated herself for not having borne children when she could. "I'm sorry," she whispered, seeing the face of her father before her. Then she disciplined herself and put aside her despair. The only control she had over the situation was self-control, and she was not about to relinquish it for the dubious pleasure of indulging her doubts, fears, and regrets. As long as she was the master of her thoughts and feelings, she was not entirely helpless. It was the smallest of freedoms, that of one's own mind, but she was grateful for it, and knowing that it might soon be torn away made her all the more determined to exercise it. In any event, she still had one final duty to perform, to resist her interrogation. To that end, she would need to be in full command of herself, otherwise she would break quickly. She slowed her breathing and concentrated on the regular flow of air through her throat and nostrils, letting that sensation crowd out all others. When she felt appropriately calm, she set about deciding what was safe to think about. So many subjects were dangerous. Dangerous to her, dangerous to the Varden, dangerous to her allies, or dangerous to Aragorn and Saphira. She did not review the things she ought to avoid, which might have given her jailers the information they wanted then and there. Instead, she picked a handful of thoughts and memories that seemed benign and strove to ignore the rest, strove to convince herself that everything she was and had ever been consisted of only those few elements. In essence, she attempted to create a new and simpler identity for herself, so that when asked questions about this or that, she could, with complete honesty, plead ignorance. It was a dangerous technique. For it to work, she had to believe her own deception, and if she was ever freed, it might be difficult to reclaim her true personality. But then she had no hope of rescue or release. All she dared hope for was to frustrate the designs of her captors.
"Gokukara, give me the strength to endure the trials before me. Watch over your little owlet, and should I die, carry me safely from this place. Carry me safely to the fields of my father."
Her gaze wandered about the tile-covered room as she studied it in greater detail. She guessed she was in Urabane. It was only logical that Murtagh and Thorn would have taken her there, and it would explain the elvish look of the room. The elves had built much of Urabane, the city they called Illyria, either before their war with the dragons, long, long ago, or after the city had become the capital of the Brodring Kingdom, and the riders had established a formal presence therein. Or so her father had told her. She remembered nothing of the city herself. Still, she might be somewhere else entirely, one of Galbatorix's private estates, perhaps. And the room might not even exist as she perceived it. A skilled magician could manipulate everything she saw, felt, heard, and smelled, could distort the world around her in ways she would never notice. Whatever happened to her, whatever seemed to happen to her, she would not allow herself to be tricked. Even if Aragorn broke down the door and cut her loose, she would still believe that it was a ruse of her captors. She dared not trust the evidence of her senses. The moment Murtagh had taken her from the camp, the world had become a lie, and there was no telling when the lie would end, if it ever did. The only thing she could be certain of was that she existed. All else was suspect, even her own thoughts. After her initial shock subsided, the tedium of waiting began to wear on her. She had no way to tell time, other than her hunger and thirst, and her hunger waxed and waned at seemingly irregular intervals. She tried marking off the hours by counting numbers, but the practice bored her, and she always seemed to forget her place once she reached the tens of thousands. Despite the horrors she was sure awaited her, She wished her captors would hurry up and show themselves. She shouted for minutes on end, but heard only plaintive echoes in response. The dull light behind her never wavered, never dimmed. She assumed it was a flameless lantern, similar to those the dwarves made. The glow made it hard to sleep, but eventually exhaustion overcame her, and she dozed off. The prospect of dreaming terrified her. She was most vulnerable when asleep, and she feared that her unconscious mind would conjure up the very information she was trying to keep hidden. She had little choice in the matter, however. Sooner or later, she had to sleep, and forcing herself to stay awake would only end up making her feel worse. So she slept, but her rest was fitful and unsatisfying, and she still felt tired when she woke. A boom startled her. Somewhere above and behind her, she heard a latch being lifted, and then the creak of a door swinging open. Her pulse quickened. As best she could tell, over a day had passed since she had first regained consciousness. She was painfully thirsty, her tongue felt swollen and sticky, and her entire body ached from being confined in one position for so long. Footsteps descending stairs, soft-soled boots shuffling against stone. A pause. Metal clinked. Keys? Knives? Something worse? Then the footsteps resumed. Now they were approaching her, drawing closer, closer. A portly man dressed in a grey woolen tunic entered her field of vision, carrying a silver platter with an assortment of food, cheese, bread, meat, wine, and water. He stooped and placed the platter by the base of the wall, then turned and walked over to her, his stride short, quick, and precise, dainty almost. Wheezing slightly, he leaned against the edge of the slab and stared down at her. His head was like a gourd, bulbous at the top, bulbous at the bottom, and narrow in the middle. He was clean-shaven and mostly bald, except for a fringe of dark, close-cropped hair that ran about his skull. The upper part of his forehead was shiny, his fleshy cheeks were ruddy, and his lips were as grey as his tunic. His eyes were unremarkable, brown and close-set. He smacked his tongue, and she saw that his teeth met on end like the jaws of a clamp, and that they protruded farther than normal from the rest of his face, giving him a slight but noticeable muzzle. On his warm, moist breath hung the smell of liver and onions. In her famished condition, she found the odour nauseating. She was acutely aware of her state of undress as the man's gaze roamed over her body. It made her feel vulnerable, as if she were a toy or a pet laid out for his enjoyment. Anger and humiliation brought a hot flush to her cheeks. Determined not to wait for him to make his intentions known, she tried to speak, to ask him for water, but her throat was too parched. All she could do was croak. The grey-suited man tutted, and to her astonishment, began to undo her restraints. The moment she was free, she sat up on the slab, formed a blade with her right hand, and swung it toward the side of the man's neck. He caught her wrist in mid-air, seemingly without effort. She growled and jabbed at his eyes with the fingers of her other hand. Again, he caught her wrist. She wrenched back and forth, but his grip was too strong to break. Her wrists might as well have been encased in stone. Frustrated, she lunged forward and sank her teeth into the man's right forearm. Hot blood gushed into her mouth, salty and coppery. She choked, but kept biting down, even as blood leaked out from under her lips. Between her teeth and against her tongue, she could feel the muscles of the man's forearm flexing like so many trapped snakes trying to escape. Other than that, he failed to react. At last she released his arm, drew back her head, and spat his blood onto his face. Even then the man continued to regard her with the same flat expression, neither blinking nor showing any sign of pain or anger. She wrenched at his hands once more, then swung her hips and legs around on the slab to kick him in the stomach. Before she could land the blow, he let go of her left wrist and slapped her across the face, hard. A white light flashed behind her eyes, and a soundless explosion seemed to erupt around her. Her head snapped to one side, her teeth clacked together, and pain lanced down her spine from the base of her skull. When her sight cleared, she sat glaring at the man. But she made no move to attack him again. She understood she was at his mercy. She understood she needed to find something to cut his throat or stab him through the eye if she was going to overpower him. He let go of her other wrist and reached into his tunic to retrieve a dull white kerchief. He dabbed at his face, wiping off every drop of blood and spittle. Then he tied the kerchief around his injured forearm, using his clamp-like teeth to hold one end of the cloth. She flinched as he reached out and grasped her by the upper arm, his large, thick fingers encircling her limb. He pulled her off the ash-coloured slab, and her legs gave way as she struck the floor. She hung like a doll from the man's grip, her arm twisted at an awkward angle above her head. He hoisted her onto her feet. This time, her legs held. Half-supporting her, he guided her around to a small side door she had been unable to see from where she lay on her back. Next to it was a short flight of stairs that led to a second larger door, the same door through which her jailer had entered. It was closed, but there was a small metal grate in the middle, and through it she glimpsed a well-lit tapestry hanging against a smooth stone wall. The man pushed open the side door and escorted her into a narrow privy chamber. To her relief, he left her there alone. She searched the bare room for anything she could use as a weapon or a means to escape, but to her disappointment found only dust, wood shavings, and more ominously, dried bloodstains. So she did what she was expected to do, and when she emerged from the privy chamber, the sweating, grey-suited man took her arm again and walked her back to the slab. As they neared it, she began to kick and struggle. She would rather be hit than allow him to restrain her as before. For all her efforts, however, she could not stop or slow the man. His limbs were like iron beneath her blows, and even his seemingly soft paunch gave but little when she struck it. Handling her as easily as if she were a small child, he lifted her onto the slab, pressed her shoulders flat against the stone, and then locked the manacles around her wrists and ankles. Lastly, he pulled the leather belt over her forehead and cinched it down, hard enough to hold her head in place, but not so hard as to cause her pain. She expected him to go and eat his lunch, or supper, or whatever meal it was, but instead he picked up the platter, carried it over to her, and offered her a drink of watered wine. It was difficult to swallow while lying on her back, so she had to quickly sip the liquid from the silver chalice he pressed to her mouth. The feeling of the diluted wine coursing down her dry throat was one of cool, soothing relief. When the chalice was empty, the man put it aside, cut slices of bread and cheese, and held them out toward her. "What?" she said, her voice finally responding to her commands.
"What is your name?"
The man gazed at her without emotion. His bulbous forehead gleamed like polished ivory in the light of the flameless lantern. He pushed the bread and cheese toward her.
"Who are you? Is this Urabain? Are you a prisoner like me? We could help each other, you and I. Galbatorix isn't all-knowing. Together we could find a way to escape. It may seem impossible, but it isn't, I promise."
She continued to speak in a low, calm voice, hoping to say something that would either gain the man's sympathy or appeal to his self-interest. She knew she could be persuasive. Long hours of negotiating on the Varden's behalf had proven that to her satisfaction. But her words seemed to have no effect on the man. Save for his breathing, he might as well have been dead as he stood there, bread and cheese extended. That he was deaf occurred to her, but he had noticed when she tried to ask for water, so she dismissed the possibility. She talked until she exhausted every argument and appeal she could think of, and when she stopped, pausing to find a different approach, the man placed the cheese and bread against her lips and held it there. Furious, she willed him to take it away but his hand never budged, and he continued to stare at her with the same blank, disinterested look. The nape of her neck prickled as she realized his manner was not an affectation. She really did mean nothing to him. She would have understood if he hated her, or if he had taken a perverse pleasure in tormenting her, or if he had been a slave, reluctantly carrying out Galbatorix's orders. But none of those things seemed true. Rather, he was indifferent, devoid of even the slightest shred of empathy. He would, she had no doubt, kill her just as readily as he would tend to her, and with no more concern than one might have for crushing an ant. Silently cursing the necessity of it, she opened her mouth and allowed him to place the pieces of bread and cheese on her tongue, despite the urge she felt to bite his fingers. He fed her, like a child, by hand putting each morsel of food into her mouth as carefully as if it were a hollow orb of glass that might shatter at any sudden movement. A deep sense of loathing gathered within her. To go from being the leader of the greatest alliance in the history of Alagazia to... No, none of that existed. She was her father's daughter. She had lived in Cirda in the dust and the heat, among the echoing calls of the merchants in the bustling marketplace streets. That was all. She had no reason to be haughty, no reason to resent her fall. Nevertheless, she hated the man looming over her. She hated that he insisted on feeding her when she could have done so herself. She hated that Galbatorix, or whoever was overseeing her captivity, was trying to strip her of her pride and dignity. And she hated that, to a degree, they were succeeding. She was, she decided, going to kill the man. If she could accomplish only one more thing in her life, she wanted it to be the death of her jailer. Short of escape, nothing else would give her as much satisfaction. Whatever it takes, I'll find a way. The idea pleased her, and she ate the rest of the meal with relish, all the while plotting how she might arrange the man's demise. When she was finished, the man took the tray and left. She listened to his footsteps recede, to the door opening and closing behind her, to the snick of the latch snapping shut, and then to the heavy, doom-laden sound of a beam falling into place across the outside of the door. Then once again, she was alone, with nothing to do but wait and dwell upon the ways of murder. For a while she amused herself by tracing one of the lines painted on the ceiling, and attempting to determine whether it had a beginning or an end. The line she chose was blue. The colour appealed to her because of its associations with the one person whom, above all else, she dared not think of. In time she grew bored with the lines and with her fantasies of revenge, and she closed her eyes and slipped into an uneasy half-sleep, where the hours seemed, with the paradoxical logic of nightmares, to pass both faster and slower than normal. When the man in the grey tunic returned, she was almost glad to see him, a reaction for which she despised herself, considering it a weakness. She was not sure how long she had been waiting, could not be sure unless someone told her, but she knew it had been a shorter period than before. Still, the wait had felt interminable, and she had feared that she was to be left strapped down and isolated, though not ignored, surely not that, for the same drawn-out stretch. To her disgust, she found herself grateful that the man was going to visit her more often than she had originally thought. Lying motionless on a flat piece of stone for so many hours was painful enough, but to be denied contact with any other living creature, even one as lumpish and abhorrent as her jailer, was a torture in and of itself, and was by far the harder trial to bear. As the man unlocked her from her restraints, she noted that the wound on his forearm had been healed. The skin was as smooth and pink as a suckling pig's. She refrained from fighting, but on the way to the privy room, she pretended to stumble and fall, hoping to get near enough to the platter that she might steal the small paring knife the man used to cut the food. However, the platter proved too far away, and the man was too heavy for her to drag toward it without alerting him to her intentions. Her ploy having failed, she forced herself to submit calmly to the rest of the man's ministrations. She needed to convince him that she had given up, so he would grow complacent, and if she was lucky, careless. While he fed her, she studied his fingernails. Previously, she had been too angry to pay them heed, but now that she was calmer, the oddity of them fascinated her. His nails were thick and highly arched. They were set deep within the flesh, and the white moons by the cuticles were large and broad. In all, no different from the nails of many of the men and dwarves she had dealt with. When had she dealt with them? She did not remember. What set his nails apart was the care with which they had been cultivated. And cultivated seemed the right description to her, as if the nails were rare flowers a gardener had devoted long hours to tending. The cuticles were neat and trim, with no sign of tears, while the nails themselves had been cut straight across, not too long, not too short, and the edges smoothly beveled. The tops of the nails had been polished until they shone like glazed pottery, and the skin surrounding them looked as if oil or butter had been rubbed into it. Except for elves, she had never seen a man with such perfect nails. Elves? She shook off the thought, irritated with herself. She knew no elves. The nails were an enigma, a strangeness in an otherwise understandable setting, a mystery that she wanted to solve, even though it was probably futile to try. She wondered who was responsible for the nails' exemplary condition. Was it the man himself? He seemed overly fastidious, and she could not imagine he had a wife or daughter or servant or anyone else close to him who would lavish so much attention on the caps of his fingers. Of course, she realized she might be mistaken. Many a battle-scarred veteran, grim, close-mouthed men, whose only loves seemed to be wine, women, and war, had surprised her with some facet of their character that was at odds with their outward guise. A knack for wood-carving, a tendency to memorize romantic poems, a fondness for hounds, or a fierce devotion to a family that they kept hidden from the rest of the world. It had been years before she had learned that George... She cut off the thought before it went any further. In any event, the question she kept turning over in her mind was a simple one. Why? Motivation was telling, even when such a small thing as fingernails were concerned. If the nails were the work of someone else, then they were a labor of either great love or great fear. But she doubted that was the case. Somehow it felt wrong. If instead they were the work of the man himself, then any number of explanations were possible. Perhaps his nails were a way for him to exert a modicum of control over a life that was no longer his own. Or perhaps he felt they were the only part of himself that was or could be attractive. Or perhaps caring for them was merely a nervous tic, a habit that served no other purpose except to while away the hours. Whatever the truth might be, the fact remained that someone had cleaned and trimmed and buffed and oiled his fingernails, and it had not been a casual or inattentive effort. She continued to ponder the matter while she ate, barely tasting her food. Occasionally, she glanced up to search the man's heavy face for one clue or another, but always without success. Upon feeding her the last piece of bread, the man pushed himself off the edge of the slab, picked up the platter, and turned away. She chewed and swallowed the bread as fast as she could without choking. Then, her voice hoarse and creaky from disuse, she said, "You have nice fingernails. They're very shiny." The man paused in mid-step, and his large, ponderous head swiveled toward her. For a moment she thought he might strike her again, but then his grey lips slowly split, and he smiled at her, showing both his upper and lower rows of teeth. She suppressed a shudder. He looked as if he were about to bite the head off a chicken. Still with the same unsettling expression, the man continued out of her range of sight, and a few seconds later, she heard the door to her cell open and close. Her own smile crept across her lips. Pride and vanity were weaknesses that she could exploit. If there was one thing she was skilled at, it was the ability to bend others to her will. The man had given her the tiniest of handholds, no more than a finger hold, really, or rather a fingernail hold, as it were. But it was all she needed. Now she could begin to climb.
The Hall of the Soothsayer. The third time the man visited her, Nasawada was sleeping. The sound of the door banging open caused her to jolt awake, heart pounding. It took her a few seconds to remember where she was. When she did, she frowned and blinked, trying to clear her eyes. She wished she could rub them. Her frown deepened as she looked down her body and saw that there was still a small damp spot on her shift where a drop of watered wine had fallen during her meal. Why has he returned so soon? Her heart sank as the man walked past her carrying a large copper brazier full of charcoal, which he set upon its legs a few feet away from the slab. Resting in the charcoal were three long irons. The time she had dreaded had finally arrived. She tried to catch his eye, but the man refused to look at her as he took flint and steel from a pouch on his belt and lit a nest of shredded tinder in the center of the brazier. As sparks smoldered and spread, the tinder glowed like a ball of red-hot wires. The man bent, puckered his lips, and blew on the incipient fire, gentle as a mother kissing her child, and the sparks sprang into lambent flames. For several minutes he tended the fire, building a bed of coals several inches thick, the smoke rising to a grate far above. She watched with morbid fascination, unable to tear her gaze away, despite what she knew awaited her. Neither he nor she spoke. It was as if they were both too ashamed of what was about to take place for either to acknowledge it. He blew on the coals again, then turned as if to approach her.
"Don't give in," she told herself, stiffening.
She clenched her fists and held her breath as the man walked toward her, closer, closer. A feather-like touch of wind brushed her face as he strode past her, and she listened to his footsteps dwindle into silence as he climbed the stairs and left the room. A faint gasp escaped her as she relaxed slightly. Like lodestones, the bright coals drew her gaze back toward them. A dull, rust-colored glow was creeping up the iron rods that stuck out of the brazier. She wet her mouth and thought how nice a drink of water would be. One of the coals jumped and split in two, but otherwise the chamber was quiet. As she lay there, unable to fight or escape, she strove not to think. Thinking would only weaken her resolve. Whatever was going to happen was going to happen, and no amount of fear or anxiety could change that. New footsteps sounded in the hallway outside the chamber, a group of them this time, some marching in rhythm, some not. Together they created a host of raucous echoes that made it impossible to determine the number of people approaching. The procession stopped by the doorway, and she heard voices murmuring. And then two sets of clacking footsteps, the product of hard-soled riding boots, she guessed, entered the room. The door closed with a hollow thud. Down the stairs the footsteps came, steady and deliberate. She saw someone's arm place a carved wooden chair at the very edge of her vision. A man sat in it. He was large, not fat, but broad-shouldered. A long black cape hung draped around him. It looked heavy, as if backed with mail. Light from the coals and from the flameless lantern gilded the edges of his form, but his features remained too dark to make out. Still, the shadows did nothing to hide the outline of the sharp, pointed crown that rested upon his brow. Her heart skipped a beat. With a struggle, it resumed its previous rapid tempo. A second man, this one dressed in a maroon jerkin and leggings, both trimmed with gold thread, walked over to the brazier and stood with his back to her, while he stirred the coals with one of the iron rods. One by one, the man in the chair tugged on the fingers of his gauntlets. Then he pulled off the gloves. Underneath, his hands were the colour of tarnished bronze. When he spoke, his voice was low, rich, and commanding. Any bard who possessed such a mellifluous instrument would have his name praised throughout the land as a master of masters. The sound of it caused her skin to prickle. His words seemed to wash over her like warm waves of water, caressing her, beguiling her, binding her. Listening to him, she realized, was as perilous as listening to Elva. "Welcome to Urbane, Nasawada, daughter of Ajahad," said the man in the chair. "Welcome to this, my home, neath these ancient piled rocks. Long has it been since a guest as distinguished as yourself has graced us with their presence. My energies have been occupied elsewhere, but I assure you, from now on, I shall not neglect my duties as host." At the last, a note of menace crept into his voice, like a claw emerging from its sheath. She had never seen Galbatorix in person, only heard descriptions and studied drawings. But the effect the man's speech had on her was so visceral, so powerful, she had no doubt that he indeed was the king. In both his accent as well as his diction, there was something of the other, as if the language he spoke was not the language he had been raised with. It was a subtle difference, but impossible to ignore once she noticed. Perhaps, she decided, it was because the language had changed in the years since he had been born. That seemed the most reasonable explanation, as his way of speaking reminded her... No, it reminded her of nothing. He leaned forward, and she could feel his gaze boring into her. "You are younger than I expected. I knew you had but recently come of age, but still you are no more than a child. Most seem as children to me these days, prancing, preening, foolhardy children who know not what is best for them. Children who need the guidance of those who are older and wiser." "Such as yourself?" she said in a scornful tone. She heard him chuckle. "Would you rather the elves ruled over us? I am the only one of our race who can hold them at bay. By their reckoning, even our oldest greybeards would be considered untested youths, unfit for the responsibilities of adulthood."
"By their reckoning, so would you."
She did not know where her courage came from, but she felt strong and defiant. Whether or not the king would punish her for it, she was determined to speak her mind.
"Ah, but I contain more than my share of years. The memories of hundreds are mine. Life piled upon life. Loves, hates, battles, victories, defeats, lessons learned, mistakes made. All lie within my mind, whispering their wisdom into my ears. I remember eons. In the whole of recorded history, there has never been one such as I, not even among the elves."
"How is that possible?" she whispered.
He shifted in the chair.
"Do not think to pretend with me, Nasawada. I know that Glader gave his heart of hearts to Aragorn and Saphira, and that he is there with the Varden even now. You understand whereof I speak."
She suppressed a thrill of fear. The fact that Galbatorix was willing to discuss such things with her, that he was willing to refer even obliquely to the source of his power, eliminated what little hope she still had that he ever intended to release her. Then he gestured at the room with his gauntlets.
"Before we proceed, you should know something of the history of this place. When the elves first ventured to this part of the world, they discovered a crevice buried deep within the escarpment that looms over the plains hereabout. The escarpment they prized as defense against the attacks of dragons, but the crevice they prized for an entirely different reason. By happenstance, they discovered that the vapours rising out of the crack in the stone increased the chances that those who slept near it might catch a glimpse, if however confused, of future events. So over 2,500 years ago, the elves built this room atop the fissure, and an oracle came to live here for many hundreds of years, even after the elves abandoned the rest of Illyria. She sat where you now lie, and she whiled away the centuries, dreaming of all that had been and all that might be. In time, the air lost its potency, and the oracle and her attendants departed. Who she was and where she went, none can say for sure. She had no name other than the title Soothsayer, and certain stories lead me to believe she was neither elf nor dwarf, but something else entirely. Be that as it may, during her residency, this chamber came to be called, as you might expect, the Hall of the Soothsayer. And so it still is today. Only now you are the soothsayer, Nasawada, daughter of Ajahad. Galbatorix spread his arms. This is a place for truths to be told and heard. I will tolerate no lies within these walls, not even the simplest of falsehoods. Whosoever rests upon that hard block of stone becomes the latest soothsayer. And though many have found that role difficult to accept, in the end, none have refused. You will be no different. The legs of the chair scraped over the floor, and then she felt Galbatorix's breath warm against her ear. I know this will be painful for you, Nasawada. Painful beyond belief. You will have to unmake yourself before your pride will allow you to submit. In all the world, nothing is harder than changing one's own self. I understand this, for I have reshaped myself on more than one occasion. However, I will be here to hold your hand and help you through this transition. You need not take the journey alone, and you may console yourself with the knowledge that I will never lie to you. None of us shall. Not within this room. Doubt me if you wish, but in time you will come to believe me. I consider this a hallowed place, and I would no more desecrate the idea it represents than cut off my own hand. You may ask whatever you want, and I promise you, Nasawada, daughter of Ajahad, that we shall answer truthfully. As king of these lands, I give you my sworn word. She worked her jaw back and forth, trying to decide how to answer. Then from between clenched teeth, she said, I'll never tell you what you want to know. A slow, deep chuckle filled the room. You misunderstand. I didn't have you brought here because I seek information. There's nothing you could say that I don't already know. The number and disposition of your troops, the state of your provisions, the locations of your supply trains, the manner in which you plan to lay siege to this citadel, Aragorn and Saphira's duties, habits, and abilities, the Dauthdert you acquired in Bellatona, even the powers of the witch-child Elva, whom you have kept by your side until but recently. All this I know, and more. Shall I quote the figures to you? No? Well then. My spies are more numerous and more highly placed than you imagine, and I have other means of gathering intelligence withal. You have no secrets from me, Nasawada, none whatsoever. Therefore it is pointless to insist upon holding your tongue. His words struck her like hammer blows, but she strove not to let them dishearten her. Why then? Why did I have you brought here? Because, my dear, you have the gift of command, and that is far deadlier than any spell. Aragorn is no threat to me, nor are the elves. But you are dangerous, in a way they are not. Without you, the Varden will be like a blinded bull. They will snort and rage, and they will charge straight ahead, heedless of what lies in their way. Then I will catch them, and with their folly, destroy them. But the destruction of the Varden is not the reason I had you abducted. No, you are here because you have proven yourself worthy of my attention. You are fierce, tenacious, ambitious, and intelligent. The very qualities I prize most in my servants. I wish to have you by my side, Nasawada, as my foremost advisor and as the general of my army, as I move to implement the final stages of the great plan I have been laboring upon for nigh on a century. A new order is about to descend upon Alagazia, and I would have you be a part of it. Ever since the last of the 13 died, I have searched for those who were fit to take their place. Until recently, my efforts have been in vain. Durza was a useful tool, but being a Shade, he had certain limitations. A lack of concern for his own preservation, to name but one. Of all the candidates I have examined, Murtak was the first I considered eligible, and the first to survive the tests I set before him. You shall be the next, I am sure, and Aragorn the third. Horror crept through her as she listened to him. What he was proposing was far worse than she had envisioned. The maroon-clad man at the brazier startled her by shoving one of the iron rods into the coals with such force the tip banged against the copper bowl underneath. Galbatorix continued speaking. Should you live, you shall have a chance to accomplish more than you ever could with the Varden. Think of it. In my service, you could help bring peace to the whole of Alagazia, and you would be my chief architect for accomplishing these changes. I would rather let 1,000 vipers bite me before I would agree to serve you. And she spat into the air. His chuckle echoed throughout the room once more. The sound of a man who feared nothing, not even death. We shall see. She flinched as she felt a finger touch the inside of her elbow. It slowly traced a circle, then slid down to the first of her scars on her forearm, and paused atop the ridge of flesh, warm against her skin. The finger tapped 3 times before proceeding to the next few scars, then back again, running over them like a washboard. "You have defeated an opponent in the trial of the Long Knives," said Galbatorix, "and with more cuts than any have endured in recent memory. That means both that you are exceptionally strong-willed and that you are able to suspend the functioning of your imagination, for it is an overactive imagination that turns men into cowards, not a surfeit of fear, as most believe. However, neither of these traits will be of help to you now. On the contrary, they are a hindrance. Everyone has a limit, whether physical or mental. The only question is how long it takes to reach that point. And you will reach it, I promise you. Your strength may delay the moment, but it cannot avert it. Nor will your wards avail you while you are within my power. Why, then, should you suffer needlessly? No one questions your courage. You have already demonstrated it to all the world. Give in now. There is no shame in accepting the inevitable. To continue would be to subject yourself to an array of torments for no other reason but to appease your sense of duty. Let your duty be appeased now, and give me your oath of fealty in the ancient language. And ere the hour is out, you will have 12 servants to command, robes of silk and damask to wear, a set of chambers to live in, and a place at my table when we dine. He paused then, waiting for her answer. But she stared at the lines painted on the ceiling,
and refused to speak. On her arm, the finger continued its exploration, moving from her scars to the hollow of her wrist, where it rested heavily upon a vein. "Very well, as you wish." The pressure on her wrist vanished. "Murtagh, come show yourself. You are being impolite to our guest."
"Oh, not him too," she thought,
suddenly feeling a great sadness. At the brazier, the man in red slowly turned, and though he wore a silver mask over the upper half of his face, she saw it was indeed Murtagh. His eyes were nearly lost in shadows, and his mouth and jaw were fixed in a grim expression. "Murtagh was somewhat reluctant when he first entered my service, but he has since proven to be a most apt student. He has his father's talents. Isn't that so?"
"Yes, sir,"
said Murtagh, his voice rough. "He surprised me when he killed old King Hrothgar on the Burning Plains. I didn't expect him to turn on his former friends with such eagerness. But then our Murtagh is full of rage and bloodlust, he is. He would tear out the throat of a cull with his bare hands if I gave him the chance, and I have. Nothing pleases you so much as killing, now does it?" The muscles in Murtagh's neck tensed.
"No, sir."
Galbatorix laughed softly. "Murtagh Kingkiller. 'Tis a fine name, a name fit for a legend, but not one you should seek to earn again, except at my direction." Then to her, "Until now I have neglected his instruction in the subtle arts of persuasion, which is why I brought him here with me today. He has some experience as the object of such arts, but never as the practitioner, and it is high time he learns to master them. And what better way to learn than here, with you? It was Murtagh, after all, who convinced me that you were worthy of joining my newest generation of disciples." A strange sense of betrayal crept over her. Despite what had transpired, she had thought better of Murtagh. She searched his face for an explanation, but he stood stiff as a guard on watch and kept his gaze averted. She could glean nothing from his expression. Then the king motioned toward the brazier, and in a conversational tone of voice said, "Take up an iron." Murtagh's hands curled into fists. Other than that, he did not move. A word rang in Nasuada's ears, like the clap of a great bell. The very warp and weft of the world seemed to vibrate at the sound, as if a giant had plucked the threads of reality and set them a-quivering. For a moment she felt as if she were falling, and the air before her shimmered like water. Despite its power, she could not remember the letters that made up the word, nor even what language it belonged to, for the word passed clean through her mind, leaving behind only the memory of its effects. Murtagh shuddered. Then he twisted, grasped one of the iron rods, and pulled it from the brazier with a halting motion. Sparks sprayed into the air as the iron came free of the coals, and several glittering embers fell spiraling toward the floor like pine seeds from their cones. The end of the rod glowed a bright, pale yellow that, even as she watched, darkened to a ruddy orange. The light from the hot metal reflected off Murtagh's polished half-mask, giving him a grotesque, inhuman appearance. She saw herself reflected in the mask as well, her form distorted into a crabbed torso with spindly legs that dwindled away into thin black lines along the curve of Murtagh's cheek. Futile as it was, she could not help but pull against her restraints as he advanced toward her.
"I don't understand," she said to Galbatorix with feigned calm. "Aren't you going to use your mind against me?"
Not that she wanted him to, but she would rather defend herself from an attack on her consciousness than withstand the pain of the iron. "There will be time for that later, if need be," said Galbatorix.
For now, I am curious to discover how brave you really are, Nasawada, daughter of Ajahad. Besides, I would prefer not to seize control of your mind and force you to swear fealty to me. Instead, I want you to make this decision of your own free will, and while still in possession of your faculties.
Why?
She croaked. Because it pleases me. Now, for the last time, will you submit?
Never.
So be it. Murtagh? The rod descended toward her, the tip like a giant sparkling ruby. They had given her nothing to bite on, so she had no choice but to scream, and the eight-sided chamber reverberated with the sounds of her agony, until her voice gave out, and an all-consuming darkness enveloped her in its folds.